it's your friend Adam Shartoff, the host of the Film Wax Radio podcast, and it's so nice to be back in your ears, inside your head. Is that how you're listening to me? Maybe a few of you are listening to me at home on a laptop, desktop computers, or perhaps you're in your car. I don't know. It's kind of crazy to know that my voice is swarming around you at the moment. And in just a few minutes, of course, other voices will be joining me, like always. Because Film Wax Radio, of course, is your podcast about the film industry, about filmmaking, etc. And, you know, I bring on folks from all ends of the film spectrum, I like to say, or think that's the case. And this episode is no different, no exception at all. This is episode 395. Wow. So obviously we're encroaching upon the big 400. And just a couple of days ago, I knocked out the 400th. Now, I was going to make my conversation with Abel Ferrara the 400th episode, but, you know, I'm an enormous fan of Abel Ferrara films, you know, I mean, going back to the beginning, but the conversation was a little, it's uneven, it's a little all over, you know, it's just not, I didn't get that rhythm going that I like, you know. So I thought long and hard about it. I thought, you know, it's always nice to bring a big name on. I think of the past, I've had John Sayles and Barbara Koppel on the big numbers. But I was thinking, well, who could I bring on? First of all, didn't have a lot of time to put into it. And it occurred to me who I really wanted. And his name was Onur Tekel. And, you know, for regular listeners of this podcast, you know that I talk about Onur a lot over the years, and you know he's been on many times on the podcast. And so Onur has a brand new film out. It's out right now. It may be in New York. It came out last Friday in New York and in a couple and some other cities. And it's probably in many cities around the country right now. It's called Catfight. And it co-stars Anne Heche, Sandra Oh. There's also Alicia Silverstone is in it and a number of other people. It's also available on digital platforms like iTunes. So anyway, you know, I was in one of Onur's films years ago, and that one was called Richard's Wedding, and then he made a film called, Summer of Blood, and then he made a movie called Applesauce, and now there's Catfight. So, and I'm in a scene in Catfight. I don't have dialogue, but I'm in the scene. So if you go see it, look out for me. Anyway, so I finally met up with Onur, and we had this great long, and when I say long, I mean this is, I think, the longest conversation I've had with any guest ever on the podcast. And we talk about everything. So that's coming up in a couple of weeks because I'm going to accelerate the next couple of weeks with maybe an extra episode here and there because I've got a lot of stuff to play for you guys. This episode, number 395, is no exception. Let me tell you briefly what's coming up. Well, on the last episode, on episode number 394, I posted a conversation with Josh Kornbluth, and that was recorded at the Woodstock Film Festival. Finally, his film came out. And then Rosemary Rodriguez and actor Jack McGee, I sat down also with at the Woodstock Film Festival last fall, and their film has been coming out. It's going to be in Florida, I think in Tampa, coming out today, Friday, the 10th of March, and it's also coming out on Netflix momentarily. I did want to post this show finally about this movie called Silver Skies, which is a comedy starring a number of seniors who are acting, including Jack McGee, and such notable actors as Marriott Hartley, Barbara Bain, George Hamilton, the late Alex Rocco, Valerie Perrine. What a great cast. I mean, a lot of them are people that I grew up with, and so it's great to see them all out and in such a great, you know, set piece for them. And again, I'm going to be joined by the director of that film. Her name is Rosemary Rodriguez, and one of the actors, Jack McGee. Jack McGee is one of the great character actors of our day, and he has made, I guess he was a regular on the TV series Pitch. Not familiar with it, I apologize. But he plays a cop or a fireman or a bartender in so many films over the years on TV and in movies, and he is a very recognizable face and a great talent. In fact, he was on another series called Talents, where he played Paul Kavanaugh. He's going to play an Irishman. There's no getting around it. Anyway, so I'll be joined by them in the first segment. I mean, I'll be joined by them later in the show. For that, though, first up here is my conversation with programmer Raj Roy, back on the podcast. He was on a few years ago with Robert Kohler when they were talking about new directors, new films. It's coming up again, new directors, new film, starting next week on March 15th through the 26th of March. And so Raj Roy from the Museum of Modern Art film department is back on the show. I was really thrilled to get him back on. And then after Raj, we're going to have on, it's one of those three-segment shows, so we're going to have on a filmmaker named Fern Perlstein with her documentary called The Last Laugh, which is playing right now in various places around the country. So that's a great documentary. Again, it's called The Last Laugh. The Last Laugh is a documentary which looks at how dark is too dark when it comes to finding humor in tragedy. And this documentary doesn't hold back any punches, and it is chock full of talking heads, but we'll get more to that in just a few minutes. But first, here is my friend Raj Roy, back on the podcast after several years, recorded from his office at the Museum of Modern Art, talking about new directors, new films.
I do, yeah. How long ago was that?
That's a good question.
Well, yeah, Robert would have been.
What stands out in my memory about that day was that morning we got the press release that he was leaving MoMA. Yeah. Film Society, Lincoln Center. And so I just assumed then I got an email from David Nin that they were going to probably switch things around. But don't worry, still plan on coming talking. And so, and then I got another email that says, no, Robert wants to do it. He wants to do the press. You know, he wants to get every bit of, well, why not? Get the credit that you deserve for the work you've done before, even if you're on the way out the door. But I know he left for personal reasons.
This is 10 years for me on new directors.
Oh my gosh.
And well, at MoMA. Wow. So, but my 10th new directors. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's pretty
crazy.
I'm looking at you and you haven't aged a day. So,
well, it's all on the inside, you know.
Yeah, that's funny. And as you say, this is a nice spot. You got a nice view of
the Rockefeller apartments, appropriately enough. Okay. So, well, this is the University Club, but yeah, okay. These are all the Rockefeller apartments. So, you know, in keeping with MoMA's heritage.
Yes. Right. A good amount of money, I suppose, right?
Abby Aldridge Rockefeller was one of the founding, well, she was the kind of founding figure of the institution, and her son, David Rockefeller, mm-hmm. Is still a leader of the institution and someone everybody on the board and staff looks up to at 102, I believe.
He's 102? So, about to ask you how old this guy must be.
Yes. So, that's what a life of great philanthropy will do for you. You can live forever.
So if you're listening, all your money away. Especially, I think that is a good message in this day and age because the wealthy are getting a lot of bad press. And
yes, well, they're creating a lot of bad press. How about that?
See, good cop, bad cop. New directors, new films. My favorite New York City Festival, I think.
Oh, thanks.
It's really developed into my favorite over the years. Something I really look forward to because of the quality of the programming, of course, but also because it's like the first indication of spring just around the corner. So it has these positive associations.
I will take it, whatever it takes for people to be engaged. But no, it's true. Opening night of new directors is kind of like the spring awakening, I guess, of the New York film industry. And I mean, just given the history, this is 46 years of new directors, mm-hmm. and you know, the collaborative nature, it's, you know, of the festival itself, that it's organized by two great institutions. It just, it brings that happy vibe, right? It's, mm-hmm. this is not, you know, no one's standing on a pedestal beating their chest here. This is about a real New York landmark series organized by two great institutions and celebrating talent that basically no one's ever heard of, but guess what? You will.
Well, this year, to be honest with you, I'm very familiar with the talent because the first thing that sort of stood out to me looking through the slate is that the opening, closing, and centerpiece films are all these sort of Sundance indies, I believe. Yep. All three are.
They were, yeah.
Which I don't remember that being the case before.
And, you know, I think it wasn't until we had confirmed the schedule that that was clear to me, at least, as well. You know, because we don't... the choices for new directors are very individual, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think when we were looking at those three kind of marquee slots, we're definitely thinking what's best for the films and what's best for those, you know, those slots, or, you know, the, mm-hmm. the pressure that comes with each of those positions. And the fact that they're all three great New York stories, mm-hmm. Or New York region at least, the fact that they're really ushering in talent that, you know, we have confidence is going to go a long way. And that we, is specifically with Person to Person, that, you know, the Film Society has a long history with that filmmaker. So it just kind of came together very naturally. And look, the fact that these are three buzzy titles out of Sundance, and, you know, that that brings a little energy with it, too. And sure, we're not opposed to
right,
that.
Right.
So,
yeah. Right. Having said that, there's still this very strong emphasis on, or emphasis on, international
absolutely
filmmakers,
yeah.
you know, and films. That has to also, I assume, play some role in the curating. Well, let's take a step back. You're, sure. you how many are on this committee? As you said, it's a collaboration between the MoMA Film Department and Film Society Lincoln Center.
Correct.
All petty grievances are temporarily put aside.
No jealousies, no competition.
And so who else is on your committee?
Absolutely. So Dennis Lim is my co-chair.
Right.
So he and I kind of lead the gang. And then there are two others from each organization. Mm-hmm. So it's a total of six curators, mm-hmm. Opining and advocating for, you know, the titles and the filmmakers they believe in.
So you duke it out for, you all come with, from having gone to Berlin.
Absolutely.
Cannes.
Yeah.
Sundance, of course, we've mentioned maybe Locarno,
Toronto, for sure.
Telluride, perhaps.
Yep.
Toronto, of course. Okay, I should have just mentioned that. I don't know, Berlin, whatever. And then,
yep.
and then it's a matter of making your case.
That's right. I mean,
because they're going to be all great. So it's
I mean, you know, the truly impressive thing is that somehow this thing works with six smart, opinionated, pig-headed people.
But they're also,
coming together.
I imagine, somewhat flexible too, because you know, at a certain point you realize, okay, they, you know.
Yeah, but
this makes them
again
sense.
Because we're only talking about 25 to 27 titles for the most part. You know, each film that is a part of the series is really something that at least one person, if not everyone on the committee, feels passionately about.
Mm-hmm.
We have the luxury of not having to fill a big slate. You know, we're not talking about 100 titles. And so that's great. It means we can be really focused and really tight. But it also means that, you know, the intensity of the passion for the curators that feel strongly has to be very high, because there's no room for meh titles in this festival.
No. That belongs to the... No, I won't say
yeah.
that. And so the majority of films come from the top festivals, international festivals, but there is I imagine every so often a couple slip in that are just end up being submitted, even though there's not a big call for submissions, I should say.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
We did change that a few years back from an open submission program to solicitations only.
Okay.
So we get we go to festivals and we, you know, observe what other programmers are looking at. We also have a network of people that we rely on to advise us.
Uh-huh.
So if it's something that hasn't played another festival, it's going to come to us recommended from a producer, a national film promotion agency, some trusted friend in the industry who's like, hey, you got to look at this title. As opposed to there's just so many people out there interested in being a part of festivals, and certainly in New York.
Right.
And we just felt we couldn't do a service to the volume that was starting to pile up for us. And, you know, And we also like the fact that we have this network of trusted friends who can help vet things for us. So
sure, sure.
Yeah.
Right. But I guess occasionally there's like a word on the street about this film that's available by this young new filmmaker. Because it's usually sometimes two, and rarely maybe this is a filmmaker who has three features. But it's almost never that many.
It's almost never that many, although there are exceptions. And, you know, there's also exceptions where it's a rediscovery moment, and we have one of those this year. Angela Shanilek has The Dream Path, and Angela is actually a revered figure. She's not in any way a new director. She's been, she's one of the founding minds, part of the Berlin School. I happened to do an exhibition, write a book about it. A movement out of Germany that actually Marinata of Tony Erdmann fame is second generation, and Angela is first generation. But the fact is, she has not had more than two films released theatrically in the U.S. So she's a relatively unknown figure outside of, you know, let's say Eurocentric festival audiences. And we're taking this opportunity to kind of reintroduce her work to New York audience. She's been introduced through, you know, programs or festivals in New York, but we're hoping that this might get her onto the distribution path. And certainly having her in the mix is, you know, it's going to be the rare exception that we have someone of her stature as part of this festival.
Yeah, but how does she feel?
You know, we'll find out when she gets here. She accepted the invitation. And, you know, look, I think there is a certain acceptance on the part of some filmmakers that, you know, you need these opportunities to reintroduce yourself every once in a while. And, you know, I know her. I know how stimulated she is by being around other artists. And, you know, hopefully that's the attitude that she's bringing to the festival experience. We'll find out during the Q&A.
Interesting marketing dilemma. It would be very great festival. I'd be very interested in something like about, you know, rediscover, or, you know, like it's something that would appeal to the potential audiences, but might feel like a little bit like, wait, I'm not an org, I'm a relic, or I'm not some sort of obscure filmmaker. But, you know, so it's kind of this thing where you I guess as an artist, as a filmmaker, as a you want to get out of your own way and not to worry too much. This is a great opportunity, as you
can be a fine line, I think, you know, for folks. But again, we're thrilled that she accepted. And, you know, certainly we're not going to pretend that she's emerging in any sense.
Sure,
but
right.
That's why the new films is still an essential part of the title of the festival.
Yes.
Right. I mean, everyone refers to it as new directors. And for the most part, that's absolutely true.
Right.
But the new films is still really important in the sense that sometimes you want that opportunity to introduce or reintroduce filmmakers.
You know, I'm right there in the choir. As I said, I've been coming to the festival for a bunch of years. But I'm wondering, you know, and then it just occurred to me, because I do remember years ago before I was in the choir, when I was just in the Glee Club, I suppose, or what. But I was like, you know, would look it over. You know, you get the New York Times, because there wasn't an internet. And you would look through, it was just the New York Times. And you would look through the slate, and I would be, well, I don't know any of these people. You know, I wasn't that entrenched, you know, I didn't. So how do you appeal to the new? I mean, I guess maybe the Sundance ones are maybe one little tiny way of doing that. But speaking to new, young people that love films, but like familiarity.
Exactly. I mean, look, that's the joy of the festival is that, you know, you're not coming into something with expectations in most parts, unless it has buzz and you've read about it, which, of course, is important, as you mentioned, like having things that launch at Toronto or Sundance or Berlin and come in with a certain momentum if you're paying attention to those festivals. But our audiences are New York cinephiles. You know, most of them are not in the industry. Many of them are not reading the trades coming out of, you know, trade reviews coming out of these festivals. So what we really try and sell, I mean, it's after 46 years, you have a track record, right? And so, you know, you can go back to the Spielbergs and the Moldovars and, you know, the Wim Wenders.
Which were early.
Early, early. But at this point, you can go just back a couple of years. Even within my 10 years, you can go to J.C. Chandor or, you know, like a number of people who have already emerged.
Right.
Anna Lily Amirpour. These are people who are already making their second, third, and fourth films who just a few years ago were brand new filmmakers.
Right.
So I think our our marketing challenge and also opportunity is to say, hey, look, you know, come to New Directors. The safe bet is out of these 27 titles, you're going to be talking about many of these very soon. And you want to be the New Yorker who saw it first.
The festival, New Directors, New Films, is taking place between March 15th and the 26th. Usually the way it breaks out is there's two screenings of each film.
That's right.
With maybe the exception of opening night, but closing night, maybe they're in the same spot because there's...
Actually, it's only opening night. So there's three screenings of Patty Cakes. They're all at MoMA.
Okay. Yeah. Three.
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
We added. It's a popular title.
it was a Sundance breakout hit this year. But there's usually, or there is, one screening at MoMA and one at
Lincoln Center.
At Lincoln Center with the Film Society. So you brought up Angela. And we've talked a little bit about Patty Cakes. Again, the director of that one is Jeremy Jasper.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
We're just reading it. And you mentioned, of course, Person to Person, which is my friend Dustin DeFay. He's a closing night film. And then the centerpiece is Eliza Hittman's film, her follow-up to Felt Like Love. It's called Beach Rats. I saw it yesterday. Fits right in. And I'm exploring the topic of a sexual awakening, of sexual identity, as her last film sort of explored as well.
And really told through a it's a very kind of masculine sexual coming of age told through a very feminine point of view, you know, both through the writer-director and the camera person. Just astonishing for me. Maybe I've seen parts of that story before, but I've never seen it told that way.
Reach Rats.
Yeah.
Agree. What were some other titles that might be? Again, this is no order, no.
I'm encouraging people to look outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah,
so
that's a good way to put it.
Africa, we have a couple of great titles. The Wound from South Africa, kind of a queer coming of age story told in the Xhosa language. I'm not going to pronounce that right, but the click-based language that's native to parts of South Africa. And Wulu, which is, this amazing kind of gangster film, but told in Central West Africa. Amazing production values. Really, you would say it's a kind of a mainstream commercial type film, but it's coming from a region where you just don't see those films in the U.S. So,
yeah, for sure.
So try Africa. As always, Asia has a strong presence. And then, you know,
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
I know that, Nigeria? One of those countries, or is it Kenya? Kenya doesn't seem likely, but one of the countries has a very big, this enormous film industry.
Nigeria,
Nollywood. It is Nigeria. Yeah. That's not what we're talking about here. But
no Nollywood films this year. But yeah.
Other than that, it's Africa doesn't have a booming film industry per se. Maybe South Africa.
Yeah, and exactly. I mean, and if there, you know, again, there are a lot of films coming out of Africa. We just don't see them here.
And Sub-Saharan. So, I'm talking about. States.
You know, there's also the titles with talent, both directorial. This is a director based. This is an auteur based festival, right? We're celebrating new directing talent, but within a lot of these films are, of course, other amazing, talented people. This is a collaborative art form. Lady Macbeth has, it's a super buzzy title coming out of Toronto. It has some incredible performances. And, you know, I know Oldroyd, the director, will have a long career, but his actors are going to have an amazing careers themselves. So.
William Oldroyd?
That's the director. Yep.
Okay. And which country is that? France?
UK.
UK, excuse me.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's an English language film.
Yeah.
Lady Macbeth. The sequel, William Shakespeare's Macbeth, I believe.
The mean as hell sequel. Intense.
Okay, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
And not that we have to include this, but it's got a theatrical coming up pretty soon.
It does, yes.
But we don't necessarily...
Many of these films will, appear in cinemas, which is great, but...
I'm sorry. I'm not going to emphasize too much theatricals.
Yeah.
That doesn't help. And I know I saw Yancey Ford's Strong Island. It's a film I've been waiting for probably about 5 years. I first heard him talk about his film about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And only now, finally, got to see it the other day. And it just
Yancey's
really
been working on this. Obviously, an incredibly powerful personal story for him. And, given his background in the field and having worked in a lot of different areas, film production and presentation, you know, I think the added pressure to kind of get it right. And it's just a thrill to see this story get out into the world. It's tough as nails and super brave. But I think, again, a local story that is going to really resonate for a lot of people.
And other local stories include Menash, which is Joshua Weinstein's, I think, first fiction feature, though it's shot documentary style. I guess one could easily argue about a Hasidic man who is struggling to keep his he's an Orthodox Jewish widower who's trying to keep his family essentially intact.
Yeah. No, and again,
in Brooklyn,
an incredibly local story, you know, based in Williamsburg, but just insights into a community that is in many ways, both in terms of the era in which they live or and the kind of cloistered environment of that world is an amazing
insight.
Could
be insight.
Just
be a foreign country, right? Yeah. I mean, although there is some scenes in at the bodega, they kind of.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great thing about Williamsburg, right? It's like, there are neighbors. So.
That's true.
Another great documentary, Quest.
Thank you.
Kind of epic length, following a family over essentially the 8 years of the Obama era and what this African-American family, their ups and downs and their kind of real life. And, you know, just the generosity of time that you don't often see with documentary filmmaking. There's obviously a long history of verite cinema that this is drawing from, but it's great to see a contemporary doc that takes its time.
I also heard good things about Sexy Durga.
Great that you mentioned that. One of my favorite titles in the festival, and I think potentially a real breakout. It won the Tiger Prize, the top prize at the Rotterdam Film Festival recently, and a very simple structure in a way, but one of the most terrifying films I've seen in a long time. The premise of a couple gets into a kind of a gypsy cab traveling from their village to the big city, and it's in a funny games kind of Hanukkah way. Uh-oh. Are they going to make it?
Yeah, that's shorthand, but it says a lot.
Yeah. No, and it also explodes a lot of myths. I mean, you know, there is genre filmmaking. There are things about many of these films that are quite familiar, but like is the case with Sexy Durga, I mean, it places you in India, a place that, you know, has been so overrun with cliche about that, you know, it's kind of spiritual and mystical nature, and it unpacks so much of the mythology around spiritual India and what that actually does in terms of prioritizing masculinity and, you know, really providing a threat to women. And the danger of sexual violence in India is something that people are becoming more aware of. But this really, in a super engaging, entertaining fashion, exposes this kind of scourge of sexual violence in India. And I you know, really applaud that he didn't just go with genre. He went also at a super important contemporary issue.
Is this the anti-Lion?
You know, it's not the anti-Lion. It's a film I loved, but let's say it's clearly in its zone and in a tradition that Sexy Durga just explodes, you know, the genre that it's working in. So
I can't wait to see it. And I did see, I started watching Album. Is it pronounced Album?
Album, yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce it.
I'd say Album, but.
What is it, the Umlaut?
Yes.
Umlaut,
the
U.
Turkish film, yeah.
Oh, it's from Turkey, about a couple who decide to have a baby. They then proceed to have absolutely no emotional connection to the baby.
Yes.
So it's obviously an ironic comedy, but is it a sort of a metaphor? Is it trying to speak about something else?
I mean, look, I think, you know, what we've discovered is so many of these films, I'm asked often is, did you take a political bent with this lineup? Did, you know, are you trying to tell, you know, a certain story about where we are in the world? And the answer is no. I mean, we went film by film and really made decisions based on, you know, our appreciation for individual titles. That said, you know, the context in which this festival is playing, you know, starting next week in the incredibly heated political environment, global political environment, I think a lot of the metaphors in the films either get heightened or shifted in many ways in terms of the way people read the films. And so there are clearly things that people are going to take away from individual films, especially films from places like Turkey or other places in the world where, you know, there are really intense political things happening, this country included, that maybe the filmmakers didn't even know or intend to be read necessarily. But we're going to keep it open so that people can read whatever they want out of the films.
And therein is the experience of cinema.
There you go.
Yeah. Thank you.
Real pleasure.
Did we leave anything out? Or
no, just come and bring an open mind and have fun. And
Google new directors, new films.
And take one of the directors out for a drink afterwards. They'll appreciate it.
I'm sure they will. And don't plan on getting up early in the next morning.
There you go.
And, so Raj Roy has been with the MoMA for 10 years?
That's right.
Yeah. And with new directors since you started?
Started right away.
Thank you very much. And, I hope to make this continue making this a regular thing.
Me too.
It's really great to
Thanks for coming out. See you soon.
Fern Perlstein's documentary, The Last Laugh, just had a theatrical in New York City at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, but is expanding to Toronto and Los Angeles, and I think other cities around the country on March 17th in Los Angeles at the Lemley Theaters, and Scottsdale Phoenix on March 10th, and in Toronto at the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema. So do not miss this great documentary. The website describes The Last Laugh as a feature documentary that proceeds from the premise that the Holocaust would seem to be an absolutely off-limits topic for comedy, but is it? History shows that even the victims of the Nazi concentration camps themselves used humor as a means of survival and resistance. Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, Sarah Silverman, Robert Clary, Rob Reiner, Susie Essman, Harry Shearer, Jeffrey Ross, Alan Zweibel, Gilbert Godfrey, Judy Gold, Larry Charles, David Steinberg. It's a veritable who's who of comedy geniuses are in this documentary. Look into it. Get tickets. Go see The Last Laugh and meet Fern Perlstein.
Two Jews have been sent to assassinate Hitler.
The doctor arrives, and who is it? It's Dr. Mengele.
Oh my God, that's awful and hilarious. It's awful hilarious.
Subjects come up that are seemingly inappropriate for comedy, and that's the place that's the most interesting to explore.
You don't
want to walk out on stage and go, let's talk about Auschwitz. No one's getting laid after that show.
Are there things that go over the line? Yeah, I'm sure that there are.
If I was standing online naked for the gas chambers, would I hold my stomach in?
Whoa!
Humor healed us. My mother would laugh like I never saw her laugh.
The Holocaust is not funny, but survival, there can be humor in that.
That was how my mother spoke. For you, I lived through Hitler, you can't make the bed.
Without humor, I don't think we would have survived.
Did you talk about how funny the camp was?
Oh, God, yes. We laughed to say, ha, 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 you'll get you there.
It's much more fun to laugh than not to laugh.
By ridiculing the Nazis, he was taking away their power.
You're ashamed that you laughed at it, but you're laughing because it's like you can't help yourself.
Just because it's uncomfortable doesn't mean that it's the wrong thing.
Comics have to tell us who we are, where we are, even if it's in bad taste.
It's important to talk about things that are taboo. Otherwise, they just stay in this dark place and they become dangerous.
You cannot live in the shadow. I enjoy life. Could Hitler imagine that I will survive and have 3 great-grandchildren? I mean, that's my revenge.
The Last Laugh is, I think, an outstanding documentary. It's really great.
And thank you.
Yeah. Let's set it up for those listening.
Okay.
You talk to people that are funny or say funny things, depending who. And the question seems to be, can you laugh at the Holocaust?
Can you laugh not at the Holocaust? Can you find
places?
Humor in the darkest places?
Maybe that's
better.
Yeah.
Only because, that's the main question, right? Like, you take someone like Mel Brooks, who draws this very strong distinction between making jokes about Nazis. The Nazis versus the Holocaust. And what defines the Holocaust for him is you can make jokes about the perpetrators, the Nazis, but you can't make jokes about the victims or the, you know, which is, or the camps or whatnot. So I don't think my film is laughing at the Holocaust. I do think that.
Right. No, your film is certainly not.
Yes. But, you know, I do think that when people hear about it, they just, even closest friends assume it until they see it.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I mean, you speak to a number of survivors, mm-hmm. primarily
one, Renee Firestone.
Renee Firestone, who is a, she's a doll.
Yeah, she's a light.
As my own grandmother might have called her. and she believes that humor and laughing is what has kept her sane. It's what kept her able to go on. Well, not everybody has been able to. Survivors,
right.
Many survivors
right.
have either, you know, in some extreme situations, of course, not survived. You know, maybe their survival ended eventually. But mm-hmm. but that also that many carry around a burden or guilt or just a sadness or depression mm-hmm. or anger, whatever it is. And so she's really talking about catharsis through humor.
Right. But, you know, there's another factor, too. I mean, there's the spirit you were born with, you know. I think she that had to be partially what
sure.
she was born with, you know. The woman that she's in the gondola ride with in the film, who her name is Ellie, and she doesn't think it's ever okay to laugh.
Right.
She might have been born with a different spirit, but at the same time, they had completely different lives before the camps. Renee had a wonderful life. She, you know, lived in a very integrated community in Czechoslovakia. She was, or is it the Czech Republic then?
Well, then it was the Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, exactly.
Czech Republic was in
right.
the 90s.
So, okay, so she lived in Czechoslovakia under the sort of Hungarian Empire. So they were of the last people to be rounded up and thrown into the camps.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a wonderful life, wonderful memories to look back on. And so she could sort of compartmentalize that and think of the good times before and think beyond the camps. Ellie, you know, was born in Romania in a very, you know, anti-Semitic community. People were spitting on her as a child. She was thrown in the camps at 15. It's a very different experience. She can't look back on any positive memories. She doesn't remember anything funny in the camp. She was terrified. I mean, Renee was 20. That's a big difference. She was there with her younger sister, who was much younger, and very, you know, much taking care of her until they were separated. And unfortunately, you know, her sister died.
And you also make a visit to a reunion in Vegas. In fact, that may be where the gondola ride took place, correct? In the
it
hotel.
Is. Yeah.
Don't make the mistake that these folks actually went to Italy or someplace. There was no scenes shot in Venice. Sadly, you couldn't go
in
to Venice.
In the Venetian Hotel.
Exactly. It would have been nicer to go to Venice.
Well, that was my dream, you know, because we film Renee and her brother-in-law on Venice Beach in Los Angeles.
That's funny.
We're at the Venetian Hotel in a gondola.
There's a theme there.
And in my mind, the last scene, I thought, okay, well, Renee and Claire, her daughter, you know, riding off into the sunset on a gondola in the real Venice.
Or Solomia. Or to premiere at the Venice Film Festival.
Okay, there's another good idea. But, you know, I'm happy with where we premiered.
Which was where?
We premiered at Tribeca.
Oh, you did.
Almost a year ago.
2016.
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned before Mel Brooks, who's in this. How long did you have Mel for, by the way? One sitting?
Once he was sitting. Well, we shot in film. And the rolls of film are a little bit more than 10 minutes each.
You shot in film?
Yes.
What was the decision for that? Now I'm going off track, but I'm curious.
I'm a cinematographer.
Uh-huh.
I have shot all of my films in film.
In film. You never shot digitally?
I have shot digitally
as a
cinematographer.
Okay.
But
for
in
others.
My work.
Yes.
The only film that I have worked on that was like, so I produce films with my husband. So he's the producer on my films and I'm the producer on his. You know, mm-hmm. we don't co-direct. The very last film he just made that was at Tribeca the year before came out last year, it came out originally as When I Live My Life Over Again, but then it was the distributor changed it to One More Time. So you might know it as either one with Christopher Walken and Amber Heard. And we shot that digitally.
I saw it.
You did?
Fellas.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I did see that one. I think I was supposed to potentially, yeah,
okay,
talk to your husband, I guess.
Oh,
I don't
great.
Know. It didn't happen, I guess. So,
well,
unfortunately.
But yeah, a great film. And that was the first thing we have both shot that was ours.
Okay.
That wasn't in film.
I see. Ironically, film is the... I've been doing a lot of talking about film preservation late, especially mm-hmm. more. I've been doing it for a long time. There's the assumption is, of course, the most reliable format for a film for preservation, if stored correctly, is, in fact, film.
Yes.
Whereas digital drives and that kind of thing are not as... They're not going to last forever. You have mm-hmm. to... There's a lot more work into preserving mm-hmm. it. Anyway... I don't want to get to take a step backward where we were talking about Mel Brooks. I was just curious because how long you had him
so
in that room.
We were shooting in film, which were a little bit more than 10 minutes each mm-hmm. role. He said when he sat down, he'll give us 3 roles, but he generously gave us 5.
That
so
happens
almost an hour.
That is great. When they see that you're not when you're worth the time.
This is a film that completely covers his entire career, and I
right.
think maybe this is a lot to say, but I think he was impressed by the research we had done because we had, uncovered things that even people that, like most people, beyond the producers and beyond, all the things that you've heard about,
mm-hmm.
And I think he had a good time.
Oh, that's good. You're right. On some level, we think we know everything about Mel Brooks, not only in terms of his career, but just in terms of how his mind frame, his thoughts. I mean, I was surprised how he talked about it, I never heard him talk about drawing a line.
Yeah, in anything, right?
No. Like, I mean, I'm sure that everybody has it, but they don't, I just never heard him talk about it or
right.
express
right.
such an opinion mm-hmm. that he does not go there, that he will not joke about the Holocaust
mm-hmm.
or about the camps and its victims,
mm-hmm.
And not to say, that seems like, that's understandable, but it's just Joan Rivers, whom he talks about and who he kind of, gives a certain amount of, says,
he blanched a little at her joke. Is that what you mean?
Well, he did, but he also
respects
that
absolutely.
She doesn't have a line.
Well,
if it's funny, it's funny according, and he understands it. He just doesn't agree.
He doesn't do it himself.
He doesn't apply it.
He doesn't judge others.
Right.
Which is really incredible, right?
Yeah.
He has the utmost respect for Sarah Silverman.
Right.
But at the same time, he's like, wow,
My nieces, their whole family is very Jewy, and she goes to Hebrew school and loves it. And she called me up and she's like, Aunt Sarah, did you know that Hitler killed 60 million Jews? And I corrected her and I said, I think he's responsible for killing 6 million Jews. And she said, oh, yeah, 6 million. I knew that. But seriously, what's the difference? The difference is 60 million is unforgivable, young lady. But kids,
And we will mention at this point, since you brought her up, that Sarah is also in the film.
And incredible in it.
You really got some great, talking heads in there.
Yeah, I got lucky.
Who else?
Okay, so started with Rob Reiner,
mm-hmm.
which...
It's always a good place to start, because he's like...
It was an incredible place to start.
He's like king of Hollywood at this point.
Well, he's just so loved
and
so respected.
And he knows everybody, probably.
And beyond that, such an incredibly nice person.
Okay.
I mean, he was our very first interview. We were like, working everything out, and he was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so based on getting that interview, immediately within that week, I was able to get Susie Essman and Harry Shearer. So that was my very first week.
Very good.
And then, who else is in the film? There's, Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks,
yes.
as you know,
mm-hmm.
Sarah Silverman, Lisa Lampanelli, Judy Gold, Alan Zweibel, who's the legendary
sure.
comedy writer.
For Saturday Night Live, et cetera.
Yes.
Original Saturday Night Live.
And he's been one of the great heroes of my film.
Mm-hmm.
He has
personally...
Champion? Yes, champion. That's what I mean.
Yeah. And it came out in Tribeca last year, and it's taken a full year, but finally, but with a film like this, I assume you could have just done endless amounts of Jewish film festivals.
You know what? And I'm just starting to do them. Okay. We have been accepted into, they're not all announced yet, but 70 film festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jewish film festivals haven't just, I had one over the summer.
Okay.
That's it. And then they really just started in the fall. In fact, right after the election.
Or the high
holidays. No, I mean literally happened in November starting.
Right after the high holidays. Now that we've forgiven ourselves,
right.
We can watch this controversial film by this young upstart. Okay, you haven't done too many, but maybe a handful now.
I would say about 10.
10, that's good.
So far.
So you have a sampling. Did you go to San Francisco with it yet?
Yes, okay. That was the first one.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
And we
played at the Castro, which was
that's fantastic,
a dream come
right?
true.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know. What are the Alta Kaka saying? I mean, they've got to have their opinions, right?
I've had incredible responses.
Okay.
I've had barely a negative response. Knock on, this is glass. That's not going to work.
We don't, there's no, oh, there's
no
wood.
Okay.
Over there.
I'm walking over to the wood.
She is. She got up. Okay.
So.
I think with 10, you can feel confident. I mean, eventually, no matter what you do, if you show it in enough festivals, people are going to complain about anything you show.
Exactly. But just because they haven't been at Jewish film festivals doesn't mean it hasn't been Jewish people coming. You know, it's
right.
not a film just
it.
For Jewish people.
Right.
But, you know, it attracts a lot of Jewish
sure.
people. So,
but every single city and town in this country has a Jewish film festival.
Yes.
You can pretty much consider it like if you go
Well, I got invited. You'll like this. I got invited to, I don't know, it was like the West Haven Jewish Film Festival. And on the invite, it said, this has to be the Connecticut Jewish Film Festival premiere.
<That's>
implying
funny.
That there were like yeah. five others. Just
well, and there are. Oh, come on, of course.
Yeah.
Connecticut.
Yeah.
There must be.
I forgot what we were talking about.
Oh, we were just talking about Jewish film festivals and the response
yeah.
from
the
audiences.
Oh, the response. So it's been generally incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have a lot of people walking out. You know, it's possible the people that don't, you know, there are people that don't stay for the Q&As. But, No.
But see, the people that are going to complain are going to stay.
It's
That's the
what
joke
people,
in the yeah. film. It's like,
recently,
what do you think of the food here? Yeah, it's not so good. But
and
the prices. I didn't tell it very well.
Well, that's what somebody said to me when I said. So I was just recently at a festival, and there was a woman in the front row. And she asked a question. She didn't make a comment, but she asked a question that I could tell she was really fidgeting and uncomfortable and not happy. So somebody in the audience said, you know, how's the response been? And I said, honestly, the response has been incredible. Nobody has really complained. And a couple people afterwards have asked me questions a little bit angry. And then we've talked about it. And they were like, oh, relieved.
Yeah.
When they heard the response, when they heard that even the woman, Ellie, who's never thinks it's okay to laugh, came to our Tribeca premiere and in front of everybody talked about how moving she thought it was and how tasteful and could she have tickets to the next show.
Right.
But at this one particular Q&A, I did say, it's possible that the woman here in the front row is one of the first people not to like the film.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it's true. I don't like the film. And instead of like going to the next question, we had a 10-minute conversation in this Q&A because point is discussion.
Right.
That's been the best part of this film is the discussion that it provokes. So I want to talk to people about it. I want them to feel like they can talk because I don't think it's a black and white issue. I didn't go in and say, look, it's okay to laugh and get over yourself. I don't know if it's okay to laugh in every situation. I tried to make a film that asks the questions, not dictates the answers, because I think it's a completely non-black and white issue.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of then of that, too, then I guess you also have a film here that might be very appropriate for an institutional distribution as well when you're going into that.
Yes.
I'm sure that's already on your mind, distribution, of course. So, well, theatrical you've already wrapped up, I suppose. But
theatrical, and then we'll have our broadcast on Independent Lens.
Right. And that's coming up on what day?
April 24th, which is Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Oh, they've chosen this film on that day. That's great.
Yeah. And then, then it'll be in like the educational market.
Right. Yeah. because it seems to me that it is controversial. There are far more controversial subjects, I suppose, but this is one of them. It's because it's not just about the Holocaust. This is about, as we said at the very top of the segment, it's about where do you draw the line? How dark is too dark? Mm-hmm. For in terms of mm-hmm. joke making humor, there's two sides to it. There's the notion of for survivors of something traumatic to laugh at to be able to find the humor in it anyway. That's almost like finding forgiveness on a certain level. Mm-hmm. You have to find forgiveness on some level. It doesn't have to be of those who trespassed against you. Mm-hmm. But there has to be some sort of forgiveness of not carrying around the burden, which people do because they have this guilt of surviving when so many perished.
Right.
And also carrying around anger it's a heavy-duty thing. It's heavy-duty for you. It's heavy-duty for your relationships. So this film really does explore those subjects, and then the other side of it is also for those who just like comedy, who just like humor, because
right.
you have a lot of comedy
Absolutely.
Who talk about where they draw the line or if they draw the line, and
it's really just using this subject as a starting point
yeah.
for the discussion.
Right. I mean, Mel brings up I'm going to call him Mel because we're close, but that he talks about how in History of the World. I forget which. It was another,
it was the Inquisition.
Right, the Inquisition. and he goes, comedy plus time is, of course, the old adage. Since I mentioned it, what do you think of that? Do you think in general in 200 years from now?
Well, that's definitely
Or even
a
50 years from now when no single person that was alive during the Holocaust is
right.
alive anymore.
Right. Well,
it's maybe much shorter than 50, even.
Well, there's a couple of things I think about that. I mean, the difference between the Inquisition mm-hmm. is there were no cameras. That's my producer.
I know her very
you
well.
You do?
Yes, very well. And yeah.
There were no cameras. There were no movies about it. There were people don't really know what the Inquisition was or how horrific it was.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully. That there is documentation that will help the memory be alive. People.
Well, there's going to be thousands of films.
Yeah. So. Well, yes. But also, people say, "Oh, when the last survivor dies," but we shouldn't discount the children of survivors.
Oh, of course.
They will continue telling these stories,
Right.
But I. All that to say that, that's certainly the fear. That's certainly the fear for someone like Abe Foxman, who is worried who we're making the joke for. But, another thing is 75 years has gone by. That's a lifetime. And it's a lifetime of memory. It means that, it's like a collective lifetime. So why do you think politics have sort of gotten to where they are right now? Is it because a lifetime has gone by and people are, forgetting the lessons we've learned and slipping back into a negative place.
Grasping fascism.
And forgetting,
yeah.
The implications and the dangers and not looking forward, being on the, wrong side of history, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a fear. Mm-hmm. I think to me that shows that
mm-hmm.
You have the first generation beyond a terrible event like that. And, it's like, never forget, never forget. And then the second generation protecting that. And then the third generation, a little bit tired.
Fatigue sets in.
Fatigue and worried about, why do I have to always be so politically correct about this or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm going to recommend people see it because the film called The Last Laugh, it's
opening today at Lincoln Plaza.
Oh, it's at Lincoln Plaza, and
opening at Lincoln Plaza today. It'll be there for, fingers crossed, 2 weeks, and we'll be rolling out across the country.
Okay.
It'll be in Toronto on the 10th. It'll be in Los Angeles on the 17th. And then we're hoping to roll out to 45 other cities. So
fantastic. You're all ready to do that.
Yeah.
When and if. Again, the name of the film is called The Last Laugh, and it's directed by Fern Perlstein.
And you can visit us at at Last Laugh Film on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or lastlaughfilm.us. That's our website. And all of those places will keep you up to date with cities we're going to be in.
And festivals and the broadcast, again, on Independent Lens on April 24th.
Yes.
Holocaust Remembrance Day. Thank you so much, Fern.
Thank you.
It was really great meeting you.
All right. Got to ask you about the controversy.
Of course.
That's been going on. You're very well aware of it, about a particular joke you told on E's Fashion Police, talking about Heidi Klum's very revealing dress at the Oscars. We're looking at it right now, and your joke made reference to the Holocaust. There are some people, including the Anti-Defamation League, who said your joke was offensive. How do you respond to that?
It's a joke, number one. Number two is about the Holocaust. It's the way I remind people about the Holocaust. I do it through humor. My husband lost his entire family in the Holocaust. So let's just start with that. So people, your generation doesn't even know what I'm talking about. By my doing a joke, gets them talking and thinking. And didn't bother Heidi, doesn't bother me.
And there are people who say you should apologize.
For what?
What do you say to them?
Why don't you worry about Mel Gibson? Why don't you worry about the anti-Semites out there and not pick someone who doesn't have a single living relative?
Any subject that's too serious that you wouldn't take on in humor?
I think that's how we get through life. That's how I get. You make people laugh. You laugh, you can deal with it. Done.
Rosemary Rodriguez's comedy Silver Skies. Silver Skies chronicles a group of working-class residents whose lives turn upside down when their apartment complex threatens to be sold out from under them. Director Rosemary Rodriguez has assembled a very high-profile cast to play some very complicated roles, including George Hamilton, Alex Rocco, Jack McGee, Marriott Hartley, Valerie Perrine, Barbara Bain, just to name a few. And the movie will be on Netflix in May and is going to also be opening theatrically in Florida at the Villages Rialto Theater in the Villages, Florida. I don't know exactly where that is, but if you live in, I'm assuming, what is South Florida, a perfect place for a movie like this to play, of course, go see it. But it will be appealed to most people who have a strong nostalgia to such great actors from not that long ago. And now here is my conversation with the filmmaker, the director of Silver Skies, Rosemary Rodriguez, and one of the cast members, Jack McGee.
Just stand right there. Don't go any further. Don't go back. Don't come forward.
But you know something, Phil? I got to tell you something.
Step back over there, would you please?
Okay.
One fresh hand.
For once in my life, I took the high road.
I wish I was out of here and so I wouldn't have to hear about Muffy again.
Muffy.
Jewish girls don't have names like that.
Of bliss.
You can't meet the memory.
There she is. Check her out.
Wow, the mystery woman.
What is she doing here, living with us? Huh?
I think I have figured it out.
You don't even know your own name. How the hell do you know that?
Can you all listen up for a second, please?
Silver Skies has been sold and goes into escrow tomorrow.
What?
The new owners will be turning the complex into condominiums.
Condos?
Your decision to buy must be made in 30 days.
What are you going to do?
I don't have a clue.
We're going to fight.
Tell her, Norma Ray.
There is no way for you to legally stop this conversion from happening.
Where are we going to get that kind of money? Huh?
I'll ask the kids.
You will not do that.
This is a working class bunch. You rich people have no idea.
Who the hell do you think you
well,
are?
You
to
lazy
talk about me
bum
fired.
Deserve to be fired.
It's time for me to move on. You're giving up? It's not like you'd ever give up.
Steve, he's
how about
me now forever.
Butch? Punch? Punch? How about Skippy?
Let's see. Well, if we met. Is that where we met in one of those clubs? Skippy and Butch?
No, in the hot dog.
All right. All right, so I'm just going to ask, while you are talking, hold the mic close because it will
yes.
block out a lot of the peripheral noise. That's it.
He didn't say and closer to me. He said hold the mic close.
Okay, hold on one second. Okay, Rosemary Rodriguez, written and directed by
me.
By yourself. And
executive producer Nestor Rodriguez, Fred Roos, and Arthur Sarkisian.
Very good. Okay, all credit has been paid. And now, and starring Jack McPhee and et cetera.
That would be Jack McGee.
McGee.
No, they tried to get Jack McPhee, but he wasn't available. He cost them too much money.
Don't correct me ever again.
Yeah. Wow, this Jack is going to be a really short or a long interview.
No, it's going to be delightful. Jack McGee.
It's going to be. So far, it hasn't been, but go ahead.
What's my first name?
Adam.
Oh, all right.
Adam.
You're sharper mind than mine. I apologize to you.
That wall is a sharper mind.
I apologize to the entire McGee family for that.
They're all in jail.
They're all going to be here this afternoon and looking for you.
And not to sound like a one who's helping to spread cliches, but Jack is absolutely that actor or one of those actors who you've seen a million times on countless movies and TV shows. And just as the bartender, cop, priest, what else?
Transvestite occasionally, if the money's good and the billing's right.
There you go.
I play a lot of cops. I play a lot of blue-collar guys, firemen cops.
Right.
It's
comes with the McGee.
It comes with this face and I guess this voice. And I've been very blessed. Nothing that I've done surpasses what my experience on this movie, Silver Skies, gal next to me.
Why is that?
Because it's about, you know, it's about a generation of people, the older folks that have they've become almost forgotten and invisible, and it's about a group of folks that have been living in the same complex for a long time. They take care of each other, they socialize with each other, and they find out that within 30 days they either have to buy the apartments, which none of them can afford. And then move out, and at this stage, whether they have kids that are involved in their lives that want to help them, and their egos get in the way, and you find out how resilient they are about how they resolve it amongst the individual couples, and how there is a great sense of hope and a great sense of love and a caring and taking care of each other. So I've worked on a lot of things, but this is by far and away one of my favorite things, certainly independent films. And it's all because of this gal sitting next to me, Rosemary Rodriguez.
Wow. I'm thankful. So not only did you describe why it was so meaningful to you, but you gave the synopsis in that description. So that was helpful. That was very helpful, so my audience knows. When did you start making this, or when did you write it? It's even a better question because.
Oh, I wrote it about probably like 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Go ahead.
No, I went to McDowell Colony after my first movie, Acts of Worship, and I had an outline that I wrote with my sister. We came up with a story, and then I wrote an outline and then went and just banged the script out. And then took a lot of years, you know, rewriting and trying to get it out there.
Of course. So it's a real passion project,
Very much a passion project. You don't have to. Yeah,
let them rest. And here's the reason I ask you that, because even though now there seems to be this wave of films, all of a sudden in the last year or two, about seniors.
Oh, good.
Well, you know, there was recently Diane Keaton and Morgan Freeman had a play couple. Interesting, another real estate subject, like where they're selling their apartment, the Brooklyn apartment, and all that. And then there's Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda in that series.
Gracie and Frank, right?
Yep. And then there's also a couple of other, one with Blythe Danner, which came out.
I'll See You in My Dreams.
I'll See You in My Dreams. And now let's go for the big money round. It's sort of like a game show. This has evolved into a game show. whoever can name the... Yeah. Hit the button and name the picture.
And with older folks, sometimes that could be a 20-minute lull.
I'm getting there myself, too. You did, right? You countered that firsthand by my flubbing your last name. I apologize again. Because I actually do pride myself on... never mind. But I do pride myself. But I'm not doing a great job. I love it because, first of all, I'm at that age now, 50-plus, where... I'm seeing these great actors, Jack included, who I've grown up with. And so for me to see them still coming, like Mariette Hartley, I know she suffered from depression. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And I know, so maybe it even was one of the reasons that she maybe worked less. I don't know. But to see her again is like, wow, What I didn't even remember that I forgot about Mariette Hartley. What a great actress she is, and she was.
When I met Mariette Hartley, she came into the casting director's office, Beth Holmes.
Yeah.
She was amazing. And she came in, and of course I'm not auditioning these actors, and I didn't, you know.
Oh,
she wanted to meet with me. She wanted to
come in.
She wanted the role so badly, and she was like just very humble and like came in just to sit and talk to me about her, how she connected with the character and about her own personal experience.
Yeah.
And she just wanted it. And I found all of the actors showed up and connected to their characters and to each other in a way that was really profound. Like, we've all stayed in touch. And I know it sounds like, oh, yeah, we're just saying that because, like, oh, yeah, we're just doing it in front of the cameras or something. It's not true. Like, we are. That's the grace of this movie, is to be able to have these people in my life.
There are no egos and that kind of thing on the side. It's nice to hear.
nothing but laughter. Nothing but laughter and joy for each other.
Because you're all drunk.
Well, that was true. Yeah, and some of us are incontinent, but, you know, it's a different continent. And we had the likes of Alex Rocco,
who
his last films was working on this.
Yeah,
and George Hamilton. And just the guys. And Jack
Who Best, else?
Howard Hessman.
Howard.
Dick Van Patten.
He passed away too, right? Didn't he just pass away?
We lose them, and that's the thing. And when you come to a certain age, and I'm 66.
Well, you were the kid.
I'm the kid in this, but I've lost my parents. I've lost three or four brothers. He doesn't even remember how many. I want to trace.
That's how many brothers you have.
I have. I'm the youngest of eight, and there's only three of us left. I lost four of them brothers in the last 4 years.
Oh, sorry.
And it's topical for me. Mm-hmm. And I have nieces and nephews that lost their dads and moms. So this film is so important to give a little bit of a wake up call and acknowledgement. Hey, these are your parents, and some of them may, if they're fortunate enough to be able to have a place to go to, mm-hmm. but some of them won't have a place to go to. And they're those same people that just are a little bit older that were young at one time, and then all of a sudden they're thrown into this panic of what's going to happen to me.
But also I think what I love, you know, the actors, is that they brought so much humor to it. It's like it gets very real, like was Jack describing, but also it's a roller coaster ride. I mean, and I see how Francis Zuccarello like cut the movie, and it's really like you watch the movie and you're like real laughing 1 minute and the next minute you're crying, because it's life. It's mm-hmm. real life. You never know what's going to happen next. And even in the, you know, with Alzheimer's and dealing with serious issues, there's a lot of humor in it. And that's one of the things I think that people respond to, is mm-hmm. like they get to see themselves represented, as well as seeing these actors, you know, and some of them that they haven't seen for a while.
Right.
Acting in the roles that they've never been given in their 50 and 60 year careers.
Right. Yeah.
This film was cut together by this Anthony Zuccarello, who is
Francis Zuccarello.
We laugh and call him a bunch of different names: Elliot Zuccarello, Francis Zuccarello. It's his first time. His first time he's cut a feature. He did such a fabulous job, because you know, as you put the pieces together, Rosemary has this vision about the story she wants to tell, but she puts as much material as she can. She gets it, and then they go into the editing room, and that's where she and Francis Elliot Zuccarello. Keep kidding him. He's such a warm guy. That's where they made the magic happen. The magic happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand. Something I'm very, very thrilled about. Don't make me cry.
Well, the movie is... Please do. No. Isn't that touching to know that you...
Well, we have up here... Francis brought his mother up from Trenton, New Jersey, Rose, and Rose turned 89 yesterday, and it's Francis
on a bicycle. He made her ride a bicycle. It's a tricycle. It's got training wheels on it, but
and it's being pulled by a car.
She got so wet from the rain. She was on the turnpike.
Thank God the tricycle was tied to the back of the car. Otherwise,
she actually expected a hotel room when she got here. There's a shed outside right next to the soda machine, and I have a tarp for you.
There you go. Accommodations.
So we're excited to be able to show her the movie today.
Right.
She's going to see her son's work. He's a commercial editor for his whole career.
Oh, okay.
So it's his first feature film that he's cut. And so it's like, it's such a joy, and to see his mom like watching the first feature that he cut, and I know she's going to love it. So. Yeah.
Well, it is for everybody. And that's what I think The reason why, I mean, I was going to ask you guys, but I have my own theory, too, of why all of a sudden stories like this will connect with audiences, by the way, because I think there's an appetite, not just for seniors to see this movie at all. I think that we're all, I think everybody wants to. You said a few minutes ago, earlier in the conversation.
Kids that have, young people. Oh,
but you said that,
that
you're
parents.
Right, that older folks are invisible. It's a good term for it. Because I, you know, I even noticed now, I actually have to, like, grab women on this train to get their attention. Where a few years ago, and it's not positive attention, but hey, right. Attention is attention.
What are you going to do?
It's
like being a priest in a small town without a car. You take what you can get.
Exactly. And so, but I'm kidding. But it's true. There's a sense of, wait a minute. So, but I think there is, on the other hand, a real, like, people are starved to see older folks represented. It's just,
well, and I think real life,
they've just been absent.
I think in addition to that, I think that, I love big movies. I love special. I love all those movies. But there is still a craving for the human spirit to see
right.
something that they relate to on screen, yeah. and that reflects their own life.
Exactly. Well, how have older folks, seniors, been represented for so many goddamn years? I mean, I don't want to make a big deal out of it, but I was so sick and tired of seeing the cute, crazy grandmother as a stock character. Like, who says that outrageous thing or says, you know, fuck that, you know, like, oh, and we're supposed to be so shocked by this. But it was a one-dimensional representation.
Because everybody likes to forget that they were young at one time. Now, you know, that these folks were
sure,
young at one time.
Right.
And they are forgotten. They're made to give some levity to it. And they do that, too. But sometimes they miss the magic because we don't listen to them.
Yeah.
Well, they have so much to give us.
Well, this is...
Oh, I have so much to give because I'm in that category now.
Well, you're fortunate to get this role and be part of giving a more positive representation of seniors, more fully realized characters, fully realized people, rather than just cardboard characters.
And
for
I
once,
had
you
know? No idea
that
it was going to have as much impact on me as it did.
I could see that.
You know, because the people that were chosen and came and did whatever, and the laughter and the guerrilla warfare that we were in, and the conditions and just the cooperation was pretty special.
You know, I made my first movie, Acts of Worship, and it's about drug addiction and drug addicts, and I did it because I wanted to give a voice to a group of people in this world that's very large, that people don't care what they have to say. They don't care about them. They become homeless and you walk by them and you barely notice them, or if you do, you just feel pity, right? And so I felt like with this movie it was the same thing. It was like I want to represent, give people a voice that don't have a voice.
Sure.
And I think it's really important to continue that. I mean, the movie is very entertaining.
It's called, by the way, I don't even know if we mentioned it. It's called Silver Skies, by the way.
Silver Skies is the
name of
the movie.
Which is just a nice, and it's named after this.
Well, that's the name of the apartment complex, Silver Skies. I think it's important to, like, open this discussion up. And for any of us, if we can spend, you know, again, with Acts of Worship, I felt like if I could get one person to walk down the street and look at that homeless person as a human being, then I will have succeeded. If we can open this discussion up to, like, you know what? Maybe if I take this afternoon or I take an hour and hang out and talk to that person that's sitting alone in a restaurant or sitting outside, or just, you know, just say hi, how are you? Just some acknowledgement, even if it's too much for your own family, but to, like, be able to do that for your neighbor or something.
Yeah.
Just to real see them in a different light. And,
well,
like,
there's another invisible population, isn't there?
Right, exactly.
So you're giving...
I hope that people watch the movie and then open that dialogue and reach out to people and let their lives get better. Because my life, like I said, is... immensely better.
Enriched
the
by
enriched.
these experiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jack, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that's the thing. If you take the chance to get into action and go up to somebody and say, how are you doing today? You know, I do it to myself sometimes because of this experience. Go up to the guy at 7-Eleven and say, hey, how are you doing today? You all right? You know, I won't give you money. But I'll give you want something to eat? I'll buy you something to eat. And they say, well, what have you been up to? I get a name connected with them. Sometimes I have to go back into my car because I'm a little older. And I have to write down the name of the guy at 7-Eleven, put it on a post-it on my dashboard. So the next time when I get out of my car, I can say, hey, Jimmy, how you doing today? You all right?
Do you really? Do you go through that extra steps?
Well, it's the same couple of guys that are there.
Yeah.
And I don't give them dough all the time or whatever. Sometimes,
but sometimes it's looking them in the eye.
Well,
and recognizing
a guy there.
That you're
somebody,
sharing this that's experience
that's
of life.
That's somebody's brother. That's somebody's son.
Right, exactly.
You know, and I know that world. you know, who have been fortunate enough to be in recovery for over 20 years now. So I know, not that kind of a low bottom, but I know what it's like to have people
grapple with.
And I know that's somebody's kid there, you know, and that's somebody's son. So there's somebody behind that, you know. And it's not an everyday thing. I don't go out there with the leotard on the cape like Mighty Mouse. Mm-hmm. But it changes my life. And with that in mind, too, since I've worked on this film, when I see somebody that's sitting on a park bench or something, I go and say, hey, how are you? Good morning. I'm good. Yeah. Tell me what's in there. What are you doing out here? Are you out here chasing girls and kidding? And the old guys are saying, nah, those days are over. I says, yeah. Well, tell me a little, what's your name? Where are you from originally? You got kids? Where are they? They got money? They taking care of you? I make light of it. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's because I get the juice out of it. Then I come back and say, man.
Yeah.
There's a guy, Saul. And usually wrote, in my neighborhood, there's a lot of old Jewish guys. So I said, Saul, how you doing? You know, I remember the name maybe. And he said, hey, yeah, yeah.
Where you live?
I live in Valley Village in California, near Studio City. But once in a while, you're walking through the park, or you're up on the boulevard, or they come and sit. They come and sit at the dog park. Sometimes I bring my dogs there.
I mean, again, I think it's cool that you do that, and I found myself doing that too. And it's almost like, you know, when you buy a white car, you don't really notice white cars until you buy one, then you see them everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's like once you take the moment, or you see I found the experience of Silver Skies is like, now I'm out in the world, and I too have reached out to people, and I see them in a different light. Mm-hmm. And you notice people more. They're not as invisible.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it's like, oh, you see them.
And we're not as uncomfortable with that guy that's standing there with a can and sitting there. There's an uncomfortability. What do I do here? Now at least I'm doing something.
Yeah.
And then it brings it out, so I'm not so uncomfortable. It's just a guy. Maybe he won't pay attention. Maybe he will, whatever. But it's about what I'm bringing to the table. And that's the juice I got out of Silver Skies.
Again, Silver Skies, directed by Rosemary Rodriguez, and a really remarkable cast, maybe led by George Hamilton, who, very funny actor, and, you know, I remember just him being the stock TV character, or actor rather, leading man, but when I was a kid, he came out with Love at First Bite, and it was like a reboot of his career as a comic
Zorro
leading
the
man.
Gay Blade.
That was the
Brilliant
follow-up.
And now
he's kind of come back for like a third chapter, even though obviously he was on TV for, doing a talk show and stuff for a while and stuff. But it's great to see him in fine.
He sees it that way.
Yeah.
He wants to be, when he did this movie, he said, I want to be introduced to a whole new generation.
Oh, that's great.
And he wants to be seen as a serious, fine actor that he is. Like,
yeah.
So not just like resurrecting a career, but like a new spin on who
he
is.
Sure, sure. Of course. I mean, who doesn't? We kind of have always been having to be in these boxes where you have to kind of be... No, I mean, this guy has a ton of great experience.
Got stories.
And he's a very, very, very... He's always been very funny.
He's Hollywood royalty. He's hung out with them all. But he has also been known for his tan, his smile,
this and that.
Down and dirty with what he's doing now in this film. This will blow you away.
Surprise people. But it was always even about that issue. He was always in on the joke. It was that's the sign of somebody who understands.
Yeah, right.
It's, again, you've heard a number of the names. Did we leave anybody? Howard Hessman, the late Dick Van Patten.
Jack Betts.
Okay.
Valerie
Alex Rocco. Valerie Perrine.
Valerie Perrine, I forgot.
Yes.
And there's another one.
Academy Award nominee.
And she's
from
still
Lenny.
Gorgeous. Brilliant. Just shocking.
She's gorgeous.
She really just
her performance and what
she available?
How she lets you in on her.
Right. These are by the way, generation of women who. Aging and, you know, right. She disappeared from the screen for that because she was unfortunately in that same age where so many of those actresses, they weren't allowed to age gracefully in front of the camera. They were discarded. You know, Barbara Hershey, you know, and then, you know, it's just, you still don't see her even after Black Swan. It's it's a shame. And it sends out positive messages also about allowing people just to get old. It's okay to get old and it's okay.
And they're not, here's the deal.
Doesn't scare us.
They're not done yet.
Right.
They got a lot to. They
got a lot
more
to say,
and not
and you
yet.
Do too.
It's only. It may not be the 2 minute warning. It's just the turn of the third quarter.
There you go.
And that's when the game's won, and you can still learn from that stuff. So go see Silver Skies, and if for some reason or other you're not happy with what you saw, contact me. I'll give you your money back.
It may not be the same money you spent, but
Don't make a difference. They'll never be able to find me anywhere. I'm going to run away to Mexico right after this interview.
Silver Skies, we're here at the Woodstock Film Festival. What's the next stop on the tour?
We're going to be in the LA Film Festival. We're going to be in Ojai.
Fantastic.
And we're going to be in St. Louis, Scottsdale in St. Louis, and then Fort Lauderdale in November.
Okay.
We have a Facebook page, Silver Skies the Movie Facebook.
Okay.
On Facebook and like us and get on there. And there's also on YouTube, there's behind the scenes clips of all the actors talking about the making of the movie.
Oh, that should be fun.
So you got Jack, you got George. Everyone has their own. There's six pieces up there of everyone talking about their experience with the movie.
Very good. And of course, it will no doubt be playing in a theater near you eventually.
We're definitely hoping.
Toss one of those my way, unless that's a Maalox or something. Thanks. I'm just doing you a favor. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jack. It's such a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show.
You're very welcome, Francine. Oh, Adam, rather.
You got it. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. This has been episode number 395 of FilmWax Radio. It's a part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network and presented by Rooftop Films. I appreciate your listening. If you do listen regularly, do me a small kindness and go to our iTunes page and give us a star rating and leave a comment. I beg you. It costs you no money, but maybe just costs you a few moments of your time, which I appreciate. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio, as well as on Instagram and Twitter. And, of course, there's the website, filmwaxradio.com. Please keep in touch. Let me know what you're thinking about and what you think of the podcast and what's on your mind. And you can do so by going to the homepage of the website and clicking on the email link. And I will read your email and respond in kind. Thank you. Please do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time.